morning. You please be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument petitioner in Sheffield versus Glenn Heights.
May it please the court, Mr. R. Anderson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. Brown. Mr. Baggett and I represent Sheffield Development Company, Inc., and Gary Sheffield, the owner of the property, which was taken by inverse condemnation by the city of Glen Heights. This case presents this court with the opportunity to apply the regulatory taking standards that it established in the Mayhew versus City of Sunnyvale case, which was handed down 4 years ago, to a fact situation that involves a downzoning of property as opposed to the denial of an application which would have upzoned property, which was present in the Mayhew case. The fact situation in this case is the converse of that in Mayhew, and the Court of Appeals on page 652 of its opinion provides a good discussion with regards to what the differences are from a factual standpoint in the two cases. According to Mayhew, the first test is whether or not the governmental regulation substantially advances a legitimate governmental interest.
Do we have, just as a preliminary matter, do you think the law is any different in Texas than it is under the United States Constitution, as it affects this case?
I think the only difference would be that the Texas Constitution is broader in terms of stating that property shall not be taken or damaged without payment of just compensation. I believe that this court has basically construed federal law and the federal Constitution the same as the case law here in the state Constitution.
But are we going to look at the U.S. Supreme Court's regulatory takings cases for guidance or for pretty much binding authority?
Your Honor, my assumption is that they are being viewed for as guidance. In addition, I don't think there are any cases from a federal standpoint that are exactly like this one. And specifically, the first and the third tests that were established in Mayhew, both are ad hoc factual inquiries. And from my review of the literature and the case law, I have never seen a case exactly like this one, which involves the type of facts that are present here in the application of the test.
In all candor, if we're looking to these Supreme Court cases for guidance, do you believe your interpretation is correct? The city is wrong, or can we just, and it's settled in federal law, or is the best we could say is that the U.S. Supreme Court has given aid and comfort to almost any view in this area, and we need to pick and sort through what is the most principled position among their writings, among their recent writings?
And I'm assuming that you're referring to the U.S. Supreme Court's opinions in Palo Zola and also the Del Monte Doom case.
Take everything since 1980. Is there a right answer in here, and maybe I'm not smart enough to see it on the first pass, and we should just keep digging? Or is there a lot of conflicting language, and we just need to sort through it and say this is going to be the law in Texas, and we allow this Supreme Court language in helping us get there?
I think that the problem is that, specifically with respect to the first and the third test, I think the second of the three tests, which is denial of all economically beneficial use, even that test is still somewhat confusing under the federal case law, but is not applicable here, even though there was a significant devaluation of the property between 38% and 94%. We're not claiming that all value was deprived from the property. When you get to the first and the third test, you know, number one is substantial advancement of legitimate governmental interest, and the third is whether or not the regulation unreasonably restricts the use and enjoyment of property. The problem is that those are ad hoc factual inquiries. And the cases that have gone up to the Supreme Court, not surprisingly, the ones that have been taken are those that have involved extremely egregious facts, somewhat similar in terms of the extent of bad facts that are present in this particular case. I mean, Del Monte Dunes is a good example there. The jury held that the denial of several development applications on a tract of land on a beach did not substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest, even though the city said there are lots of legitimate governmental interests that are present here. We want to save a habitat. We want to have some views from the roads through the beach, things like that. But if you took the totality of the circumstances in this case and the fact that in that case there have been numerous development applications that have been denied, the jury in that case held that the city's actions did not substantially advance legitimate governmental interest. What the courts point out is that it is an ad hoc, total circumstances factual inquiry, and that's why I think it is difficult to provide precise guidance with regards to the first and the third test, because those cases do depend upon the facts that are present in those tests.
And you say we're not bound by what they thought at the time. We have to look at the whole record.
Your Honor, that's the way that I'm interpreting the first test, and there's a couple of things. In comparison to the Mayhew case, this court was very specific in Mayhew, and they pointed to Sunnyvale as being a unique rural environment. City of Sunnyvale, as many of you know, is in Dallas County, and it was basically described as being kind of an island in a sea of more traditionally developed suburbs. And the court specifically points out that the people who lived there lived on large houses, they lived on ranches. Basically, the entirety of the city had a very rural feel, and the city, therefore, had a governmental interest in trying to prevent the ill effects of urbanization, which I guess is the terminology, from encroaching upon a relatively unique rural environment, which was present in that case. Glen Heights is like those suburbs that surrounded Sunnyvale. The record indicates that most of the people who live in the city live either in mobile home parks or on small lots that are sized similarly to the zoning that was on the property at the time that Mr. Sheffield purchased it. As a matter of fact, the development of the city of the 200 building permits in the 2 years before Mr. Sheffield purchased it, I think virtually all of them but one were on lots that were sized less than 12,000 square feet. So from the standpoint of trying to prevent ill effects of urbanization, it's a different circumstance with regards to Sunnyvale and its uniquely rural characteristic, and comparing that to Glen Heights and the characteristics that were present from a physical standpoint. The other issue is, and that goes back to the question regarding the record, the problem in this particular case is, to compare this to the Mayhew case, this court specifically stated in Mayhew that the Planning and Zoning Commission had a written report that it presented to the City Council prior to the vote, and it set forth numerous governmental interest and reasons as to why denying an application, which would basically have tripled the density on the property and vastly increased the potential population in the city, how denying that vote would substantially advance the legitimate governmental interest of trying to keep this rural enclave intact. The opposite situation is here. There is no legislative record that supports the vote by the City Council. In addition, if you look at the documents that the city had approved, they are totally in opposite with regards to the downzoning that occurred. And specifically, I'd like to point out that 1 year before Mr. Sheffield purchased his property, the city had passed their comprehensive plan. Now, the comprehensive plan basically is a text and includes a big map of the whole city, and it sets forth the vision of how the city decides that it wants to grow. Now, in Sunnyvale, basically the development out in the zoning ordinance was for minimum 1 acre lots. Clearly, that would encourage a more rural type of feel and environment. In the city of Glen Heights, the lowest density was to allow up to 5 dwelling units an acre, which basically is pretty characteristic of the development that had occurred throughout the city. The trial court finding of fact was that the zoning on the property, Plan Development District 10, specifically was consistent with the city's vision of how it decided that the city should grow, and that was with smaller lots at 5 dwelling units per acre. The city also passed an impact fee ordinance under the Texas Local Government Code that established how much money it could receive from developers to fund capital improvements, and that was based upon the comprehensive plan and a very aggressive growth rate. Thus, they could charge a higher impact fee in order to help fund capital improvements. They submitted a comprehensive plan to help support obtaining a park grant from the state of Texas for $330,000, saying that the parks were needed in order to satisfy this increase in demand. Throughout this whole process, the city never made an attempt to amend or change its comprehensive plan. its vision. And that goes back to the third element, Mr. Sheffield's investment-backed expectations. When he was considering purchasing the property, he asked the city, can I look at all of your documents to decide if this zoning is consistent with your comprehensive plan? He was given those. He discussed it with the city manager, city engineer, the mayor, members of the council. He went out and looked at the property, and he saw that the property, 43 acres, had already been developed in accordance with the zoning and the PD site plan that the city had approved. There were 165 houses that were being built that were consistent with the zoning. He saw that the utilities and streets were all sized and stubbed out to continue development throughout the rest of the PD in accordance with the site plan. Unknown to him, at the time that he was meeting with all of the city representatives, and he'd also sent a letter saying, please, I'm thinking about buying this property. Please tell me if there is any possibility that the city might change their development regulations that will prevent development of the property in accordance with the zoning that's in effect today, because that's what my investment-backed expectation is. That's what the trial court found, was to develop in accordance with the PD-10 zoning. And the city, one of the city council members who lives in PD-10, who apparently saw that the vacant property near his was about to be developed, began discussing with the city manager and the city attorney and the council members the possibility of initiating a downzoning or moratorium that would basically change the zoning on the property.
Let me just interrupt you real quick. Presuming that there is a distinct investment-backed expectation proven in this case, you still under Mayhew, you have to prove that there is a severe enough economic impact. Now, how are we to define, what does that mean? Does it mean, my understanding is there's still going to be a significant profit made even with the downsizing. I mean, do we look at profit made or loss, or do we look at expectation is less than what it would have been? I don't know how to evaluate severe enough economic impact.
Understand, Your Honor. This is, I guess, let's go back to the federal guidelines. And one of the problems we have is the case law has kind of accelerated in the last few years on the federal side, and there have been more cases in the last, I guess, 5 years than there have been 25, 30 years before then. What the trend line seems to be from a federal standpoint, and what Justice O'Connor has basically written, Justice Stevens backed that up in the Lake Tahoe case, was that at least from the U.S. Supreme Court standpoint, that third test means that there is no established mathematical formula. In other words, there's no specific threshold with regards to the third test as to whether or not that first element, the adverse economic impact, has been met or not. Specifically,
what test would you draw for us to be able to determine?
My personal test?
38%?
Part of what I believe that the Court of Appeals was saying is that the undisputed evidence in the record is that there was a 38% diminution in value, in the market value. And the test is the difference in market value before and after the taking.
Isn't it true that there was a 46% diminution in value of the concrete pipe case, U.S. Supreme Court?
I think that's correct.
And yet there was no, they didn't go your way in that case.
I think the point of that as well is I think the courts view these land use cases differently. And that the facts in this case, again, it's not a threshold, Your Honor, with regards to the first element. The courts have basically said you need to consider the combination of the elements inside. As a matter of fact, I think that the most important consideration is actually the second part of the test, which is whether or not the regulation deprived Mr. Sheffield of his distinctive
Impact. But it is an additional element.
That's correct.
It's an and requirement.
It is an and.
So if that's missing, we don't really get to the other. And so to me, I don't know how to determine what's severe enough.
Your Honor, I don't believe that the and means that there's a threshold level on the first test. There's not a case, at least that I'm aware of, particularly from the U.S. Supreme Court level, that applies the third regulatory takings prong.
There is
an exact number in.
No. What I'm saying is, there can be distinct investment-backed expectations, and we can find that and say clearly there were. But you still have to prove that it's a severe enough economic impact.
That's
and
right.
I'm just trying to get my arms around what does severe enough
personally, mean. I personally agree with the Court of Appeals that the 38% diminution in and of itself meets the test. I represent landowners and developers in zoning land use cases all over North Texas. I have not seen any cases where a specific governmental regulation has deprived the market value of property to that great of an extent. I think the other point to be made is that the evidence in the record shows that there was also evidence of a 90% and a 94% diminution in value. In the Court of Appeals, what I think they were saying was, we recognize that there's undisputed 38%. There's evidence in the record to support an adverse economic impact because it went up to 94%. Probably it's somewhere in the range.
Mr. Anderson, I know your time's up, but I have a question about this economic impact. I think I can go with you on the reasonable back investment opportunity, but my daddy used to say you ought to buy real estate because there's not ever going to be any more of it. And if you're just hanging on to it long enough, it's going to be worth more than what you paid for it. And there's some logic to that. So he's got this, what he had was you could put five houses there, but now you can only put four there. But tomorrow, even the four houses are going to be worth more than four houses, but not as much as five houses would be. Does it really, I mean, is there a reason why the Supreme Court seems to wrestle with this economic harm by zoning that requires almost kind of a substantial harm? Wouldn't it really be, if short of creating the zoning where it could only be done as a public park or something where you really couldn't do anything with the land, isn't there a reason why the courts kind of say if you're talking about zoning depriving you of interest, it really has to be a pretty significant zoning that eliminates virtually all investment opportunity as opposed to just kind of harming for the immediate future the value of the property?
Your Honor, if I could do a couple of responses. Number one, the record indication the Court of Appeals points us out that there was no market to develop 12,000 square foot lots in the city. That was the testimony of the record. That's what the Court of Appeals noted. And the reason for that was that there had been no building, one of the evidentiary points, there had been no building permits that had been issued for any houses that were greater than 12,000 square feet. I think it's also important to point out in the Palazzolo case, Justice O'Connor pointed out that there was economically there was some value left in that particular tract of land. Because one of the issues was, did it deprive the property of all the economically beneficial use? The Supreme Court said no, because there was more than nominal value. Basically, it was $200,000 in that particular case. So they said that there was value, and they remanded it back and specifically said that even if there is value that remains with respect to the property, that there are these other elements that have to be considered in determining whether or not the third prong has been met. I don't think there's a specific diminution amount. Again, there are three witnesses who testified that the diminution value is more than 90% in this particular case.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. The Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Robert Brown will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Baggett. I'd like to start with addressing the question that you asked, Justice Stoltz, and that is whether this court, in essence, is going to have to pick and choose the standards that will be utilized in Texas to determine what is a regulatory taking based upon the various and sometimes conflicting statements and views that have come from the U.S. Supreme Court. And the answer to that question, I think, obviously is yes. What we're asking today is for this court to determine a principled and workable means of determining what is a taking. But in doing so, the court certainly has significant guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court as to what types of regulations are so severe that they constitute a compensable taking. Justice O'Neill, you asked, what is severe? How do I determine what is severe? And you were quite correct that in Mayhew, this court determined that there was a two-prong test. It's a conjunctive test. in order to establish a taking, an applicant must show that the regulation has a severe economic impact and there has to be some unreasonable denial of distinct investment-backed expectations. The United States Supreme Court has stated that only severe economic impact rises to that level. And while they have not come out with a quantifiable, per se, mathematical number, if you look at the cases, it's pretty clear that that diminution in value has to be, if not zero, very significantly close to zero. There are cases that back from the 20s with the Euclid case where there was a 75% diminution going up all the way to Palo Zolo and Tahoe Sierra, where even today the United States Supreme Court quotes these older cases with approval of severe economic impact practically making the property valueless. In the Lucas case, the statement was made that a 95% diminution in value might be the type of diminution that would be getting the court into the ballpark to determine whether there had been a partial taking under this Penn Central factors, which this court adopted, at least two of them, in the Mayhew case. The Polestar, however, remains physical appropriation. I mean, that's really what the takings clause has always been about. Historically, the takings clause was, I take your property. I physically take it. In 1922, the United States Supreme Court, in the seminal case, Pennsylvania Coal versus Mahon, expanded that and said, there may be instances where the government has not physically appropriated your land, but the impact on the landowner is so severe that it is tantamount to a physical appropriation. The Williamson County case in 1985, the United States Supreme Court reiterated this and said that the court's task is to distinguish the point at which regulation becomes so onerous that it has the same effect as the appropriation of property.
What's the principal difference to me, if I'm the speculator, between you condemning 38% of the property for a park, which actually might enhance the value of what's left, versus you making regulations, which means I can't sell my property for too much? I mean, the amount left in my pocket is going to be the same. So what's the constitutional vision that makes those different?
Well, the constitutional vision is, quite frankly, is that they are viewed as one and the same, in the sense that if government appropriates your land, clearly you have no use of it. And what the court is saying, if by regulation they don't take your land, but they reduce it so significantly that it's akin to an appropriation, then the government should pay for it.
Well, but the Chief Justice is asking, if they only want half of it, and they physically take half of it, what's the difference between taking half of it and taking half your profit?
Well, the difference is that the United States Supreme Court has always zealously guarded physical property and the right to exclude people from property. There's a per se line of takings cases that says anytime the government physically takes your land, regardless of the public purpose and regardless of the economic impact, there's always a taking. Same thing consistent with our Texas jurisprudence when governmental agencies go out to condemn property. In doing so, you just look at what is taken. You don't look at the remainder of the land. The United States Supreme Court...
But the question is, if I own 40 acres and they come and take one, it's gone. I only have 39 left. I only own 39/40 of what I did before. If they just make it impossible to use the acre, then I still have 39/40 left. What's the difference?
Well, the difference, I think, is that under the United States Supreme Court's doctrine of the parcel as a whole rule, when you're talking about regulations that don't physically occupy the property, you look at all of the property interests involved. And it's kind of the bundle of sticks property theory that we've all heard about different times. When you physically take land, one noted commentator has said, you don't just take a bundle or some of the sticks from the bundle. You, in essence, have cut through and sliced through the entire bundle. But if you're just regulating the uses of the land, unless you take enough sticks from the bundle so that you're left with absolutely nothing, that's when we're going to find that there's compensation due, because in that sense, it is the same as if we actually physically took the property.
I understand it's important to Glenn Heights to assert that, you're left with absolutely nothing before they violated the takings without paying. But you could, it seems to me that even if I'm left with raw land that is in the middle of a downtown area, there's some real value to me of that raw land. But and so it's not a complete lack of taking, but the fact that it cannot be developed, I could not make money by creating 12,000 foot size lots in the middle of a community that's all half that size and attempt to be able to sell that. So it's not something I would do as a reasonably prudent business person. And so the city basically gets a park without ever having taken the park and hopes to hang on to it for at least the foreseeable future for 10, 15 years until the value of the land gets to such that we can put smaller lots there and sell them and the developer can make some money. So it's one thing to zone it and say, this is going to be a park, there'll never be development, which gets to your threshold of primal use. It's another thing where Glenn Heights says, gee, gosh whiz, we might be able to keep this as a park for 5 or 10 years and put the economic burden on the guy who owns the land and not have to pay for it, just simply by having zoning in such a way that there's still a development right. He's got 60% of his value there, but because it's only 60%, we know he won't develop it, and we get to use the park for 5 or 10 years without violating it. Shouldn't the takings issues be interested in that kind of scenario?
No, Your Honor, and for a number of reasons. Number one, that's not factually what we have here. Number two, as you poignantly said in your question to Mr. Anderson, when we look at the value of land, we don't just look at it at a particular point in time. Land, once you have the land, has been taken from you, it can increase in value, it can decrease in value. Political winds in a community can blow one way, one election, another way, another election. So zoning comes and goes. This court in the Taub case said that buying real estate carries with it certain financial risks, and the takings clause is not designed to undermine or to guarantee some form of profitability. And in this case, as long as the property owner has the land and there is some economically viable use for the land, the evidence in this case, I believe, is undisputed, at least that it comes from you from the Court of Appeals, that the reduction in value was only 38%. That is not to say that this land was valueless. And quite frankly, it's undisputed that the land was worth more, even after the rezoning, was worth more than four times what the applicant, what the landowner actually paid for it. So in that sense, the Polestar still must remain physical appropriation. Otherwise, quite frankly, you would open up a kind of a Pandora's box that could subject every level of government decision-making to some kind of review and scrutiny that looks at whether or not the impact reaches this 38% level, which is just so far to the extreme that it's just simply not supportable by any case anywhere, state or federal, that any party's been able to find or cite.
I'm worried about government fairness, and I assume that if there were 10 parcels that were identical and you and the city put onerous restrictions on one of them only, it was pretty clear it's because of the politics of the developer, we'd have serious due process problem.
But, and it is correct, it is a due process problem.
But here, the due process claim will be quite a bit harder to make, but there's still a fairness issue here. And how does, either we put that into our takings jurisprudence, as this court has seemingly indicated it's willing to do, or we leave it to what has to be a relatively high standard of due process, or else prisoner cases start overwhelming.
Well, I won't deny that there are a number of cases that talk about part of the purpose of the takings clause is to promulgate a certain fairness question is whether or not a particular individual has been singled out to bear the burdens of a regulation that might serve a governmental purpose, but the impact is so severe that that person alone has to bear that burden. In this instance, it's undisputed. The city of Glen Heights went through a comprehensive rezoning of property. Mr. Sheffield's land was not singled out. This began back in 1985 when the city adopted a new comprehensive land use plan, and then it adopted a zoning ordinance which rezoned 80% of the land in the city to these new zoning standards. The only thing that was not rezoned at that time were the 14 planned developments based on the advice of the city's planner to take those on a case-by-case basis.
But you do kind of get the feeling, reading the record, that they didn't want this developed. What number can we pay that will keep it? That just kind of seems to be an undercurrent of the record.
Well, I don't think it's a fair reading of the record to say that they didn't want it developed. They did not want it developed at the high density 6,500 square foot lots that the planned development zoning had put on it in the mid 80s during the real estate boom, but which had set vacant for 10 years after the real estate bust.
But there's no question in the record that it can't be developed at 12,000 square feet at the time of the record.
Well, I think there was substantial evidence that it could be developed at 12,000 square foot. Their argument is that there was no 12,000 square foot product in Glen Heights. That's kind of the chicken or the egg. The fact that nobody had built any is because there was no zoning at that time that allowed it. What the community was trying to do was to take this high-density zoning that was left over in these planned developments, many of them which were very stale and no longer relevant to current economic or contemporary conditions, and to bring those in line with the current standards,
well,
which was larger houses.
As far as the record goes, the $485,000 funding was 38%.
No, the $485,000 finding was by the jury. That was actually a 50% diminution. The case was bifurcated. There was a liability case at which there was evidence, and the trial court judge found there was a taking, quite frankly, articulating only the investment back expectations theory, very little discussion. The trial court made no findings on the degree of diminution in
where
value.
Where did the 38% come from?
The 38% came from the evidence that the city put forth at the liability trial was that the diminution was 38%. The landowner put additional evidence.
But the jury apparently found it was 50%.
The jury found it was 50% on basically the same record, but that was a jury proceeding. The Court of Appeals determined...
The trial court made no finding on it, so we're just throwing out 30% as what your argument was. Really, the only true finding was 50%.
Well, that was the jury's finding.
I understand, but that's a factual matter, and it's within their...
Correct. And I would submit that at 50%, they lose. They lose at 38%, they lose at 50%, because none of those diminutions...
Regardless, and I want to make sure we're focusing on the right number, and it strikes me that what we should be focusing on is the 50%.
Well, the Court of Appeals said that since the trial court judge who determined liability didn't come up with a number, they didn't come up with a 50% number, but they weren't going to look at what the jury decided. I had said that the only evidence in the record of actual quantifiable diminution in value was from the jury, and the Court of Appeals said, well, that's the damages phase, we're not going to look at that. I think what the Court of Appeals did is, quite frankly, rather than address the factual and legal sufficiency points that had been raised in terms of where the evidence was in terms of diminution value, they either did that analysis sub silentio and said, we go with the city's evidence, it's more credible, it's 38%, or they simply chose not to determine that particular issue, which the trial court also had not determined, and simply looked at the evidence that was not in dispute, which is 38%, and said at 38%, there's still a taking, which is the record this court has.
What the Court of Appeals is wrestling with is whether or not there's a taking is a question of law.
That's correct.
And so a lot of these tests look like they're factual questions. The diminution in value looks like a factual question. What the CA is trying to wrestle with is we have to make the threshold determinations of taking before we then assess what the damages are. And that's so they're looking to how do we cite that in law, and the Court of Appeals concludes, well, you say it's 38%, and we say that's enough as a matter of law to get you to the taking. And that basically what happened to CA?
correctly. I mean, you have to take the facts as they come to you from the Court of Appeals, in essence, on disputed facts. The undisputed fact is 38%. That is the issue before this court.
Well, I'm totally confused by that. I'm sorry. How could the 38... The trial court never found 38%. And there was evidence before the trial court of 38 and 96. How can the Court of Appeals say it was 38%?
That, by simply, quite frankly, I think, versus weighing and judging the evidence to determine whether what the actual diminution was, or remanding it to the trial court to make that finding, the Court of Appeals simply said, we're going to look at the evidence, the city's evidence, and because, in our view, 38% is enough to be a taking, they went no further in the analysis. I mean, it is a troubling part of the Court of Appeals' opinion, but there are a number of troubling parts of the Court of Appeals' opinion, such as the investment-backed expectation.
Well, I guess my question, though, is, I mean, if we were to say that 38% is not enough, is that the end of the inquiry? It doesn't strike me that it would be. It seems like you would have to look at, you know, if the CA adopted that as a threshold that they thought was enough, we don't need to take that as all that there was. I mean, there was also evidence before the trial court of 96% that the trial court could have found, correct? I mean, would that be a remand point on the taking issue?
Well, I suppose that if that has been argued below, but I don't believe any argument has been made by any party that the court should do anything other than address the issue, which is 38%. I mean, that is the legal issue. That is the issue that is causing concern around the state, for which there's some of the amicus brief being submitted. The problem is there were findings that the city submitted detailed findings of fact, conclusions of law, to the trial court that had value numbers before and after. The plaintiff submitted findings of fact that contained no finding on value before or after. Trial court simply took the plaintiff's findings of fact, struck out the word proposed. So we're left with the record from the trial court as prepared and submitted from the prevailing plaintiffs. Quite frankly, if they had wanted a finding in the record to support a takings verdict, then they I submit that it would have been incumbent upon them to have submitted a finding that said, this was the value of my land before, this is the value of my land after, this is the diminution in value, that diminution is significant enough to be a taking. That was not the case. That factual record was simply not, there may have been facts in the record, but there were no findings requested by the plaintiff on it, therefore there were no findings made by the trial court. And I submit in this case that both this court as the Court of Appeals, in essence, is you're limited by the record. And it was a record that was prepared. The plaintiff certainly had some control over that. They didn't ask for that finding.
So we have no findings as to diminution in value.
There are no findings. There is a statement that there was severe economic impact made by the trial court as a conclusion of law without any findings to support that. And what that is, we don't know whether the trial court, quite frankly, thought that there was a 50% diminution.
So if there was any evidence of a 96% diminution in value, we have to presume that that was the basis for the trial court's legal conclusion, correct?
No, you do not. I mean, the problem is there are legal and factual sufficiency points that the trial court, we don't know where the trial court came down. I mean, obviously, the Court of Appeals thought 38% was severe. I mean, it's a little bit akin to if a trial court made a finding that something was in the best interest of a child without getting any factual support for it. I would submit that you would not just look to the record and then presume that facts in the record would support that finding.
I thought that's exactly what we did. If there's a finding of law, we look to the record and presume all facts in favor of that finding.
But this is a constitutional issue, and there are a number of cases that say when you review constitutional issues, in essence, you review them almost de novo. And as this court said in Mayhew, while the trier of fact has to determine factual disputes, it's incumbent upon this court to look at that factual record to see if that factual record, in fact, supports the finding of unconstitutionality. And we believe that the evidence of diminution in value greater than 38% was legally and factually insufficient. We raised those issues. Quite frankly, the Court of Appeals just chose not to address them, but instead opted to go with the uncontroverted evidence of 38% diminution in value and said they're still attacking.
Again, but I'm sorry, I don't mean to be hung up on this point, but if we find that 38% is not a taking, I don't see how we get to a rendition.
Well,
if there are factual sufficiency issues below.
Because the Court of Appeals resolved those issues, apparently.
Well, you said they didn't address them.
Well, they said they assumed 38%. Their discussion is imprecise, as are many things in this particular opinion from the Waco Court of Appeals. My reading of the case is, quite frankly, that the Court of Appeals said there was evidence of 38%, there was evidence above that, and that the evidence that they felt was credible enough for them to make a rendition of a taking was the 38%. Perhaps they should have addressed the other evidence, but they didn't do that. But I will submit that that's not been a point of error raised in the petition of the petitioner. The petitioner certainly not complained as a point of error that the Court of Appeals should have
Why would they have to?
Well, in order to be able to make that argument candidly before this court, I would submit that if they felt that the 38% diminution was not the correct factual finding upon which this taking should be judged, then I would submit that they would have needed to have brought a point that would have expressly put this court on notice that they felt there was sufficient evidence below that to support a finding on a greater term. But quite frankly, even under their evidence, Your Honor, I'm not sure their evidence gets you far enough to be a taking under our protected jurisprudence, particularly combined with the investment-backed expectations theory, which this court has pointed out there must be a finding of both in order to sustain the Texas undertaking.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Justice Phillips, with respect to your question regarding fairness, I think it's important to clarify at least one of the comments that Mr. Brown made. The city had changed and had adopted the new comprehensive plan 1 year before Mr. Sheffield looked at the property to consider purchasing it. The PD 10 zoning that was in effect was consistent with the comprehensive plan. The city at the time that Mr. Sheffield was reviewing the property and doing his due diligence was not going through a process of reviewing tracts that were zoned planned development district to consider whether or not they should be rezoned or not. The evidence in the record is that one of the city council members who lived in PD 10, after he learned that Mr. Sheffield was considering developing the property.
But again, that goes to investment-backed expectations.
That is correct. But it also goes to the questions that have been asked regarding justice and fairness. And what I think is important here is the comprehensive plan and local government codes, it's not the Bible, but it's the guide for not both the city, but also for developers and landowners. And they can go review that document and decide if the city, what their vision is. If the city's comprehensive plan had been changed or was in the process of being changed, Mr. Sheffield's investment-backed expectations are clearly different than when he went and asked all of the city representatives to look at their documents and have discussions regarding them.
Even if it's not fair, though, you still have to meet the other severe enough economic impact prong, right?
That is correct. And again,
can you help
I think we're getting hung up, and I don't know if I'm going to do a much better job than Mr. Brown did, but I will tell you what I think the Court of Appeals was saying was that they believe, as a panel, that the 38% was sufficient to meet the test in this particular case because the courts have said there is no clear line as to what that diminution in value must be with regards to the third test, not the second test, denial of economically beneficial.
So you're saying it's a continuum. I mean, if the expectations are high and firm, the percent can be lower.
Right. And for example, in
if we were to say that 38% is not enough, do we render?
Yes. I think you uphold the trial court's findings because there's evidence in the record to support that there was a significant and severe adverse economic impact.
Why? Okay.
If your question is,
I guess I'll say if we say that 38% is not a sufficient enough economic impact,
correct.
Do we render against you?
No.
No.
Because there is evidence in the record that of three witnesses that the devaluation was more than 90%.
And do we have to presume that the trial court found those facts?
Yes.
To support its legal conclusion?
Yes, there are facts, as the fact finder, there are facts in the record that support, and I don't know whether a finding of fact or conclusion of law, but he specifically stated there was a significant or severe economic impact as a result of that.
So what we would have to say is 38% is not enough, but there was evidence in the record that could support the legal conclusion the trial court made. Therefore, we remand to the Court of Appeals to consider the evidence on that point?
I don't think there's any need to remand. The trial court found that there was a significant economic impact, and there's evidence in the record to support that.
So you say would render in your favor then?
That
we would be addressing 98%.
We're required to review that finding. If we don't know what it is, how do we review it? Do we have to presume what the factual underpinnings of that finding are? I mean, how do we know what we've got to review the factual underpinnings of that finding? What do you contend those are?
There was evidence by the appraiser that testified on behalf of Mr. Sheffield. There was a developer of properties in that area that was...
what number, what percentage do you say?
It was 90%.
And you said that we as a matter of law have to accept that?
I think 90% is...
Well, okay, if we have to accept that, presuming in favor of the trial court's legal finding, what about the factual and legal sufficiency challenge to that presumption?
The evidence was admitted, and I don't think that there was a point of error or an issue that's been presented that the evidence was improperly admitted. I think it's all in. Can I make one point, Chief Justice? I apologize.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
This deals with the first question that Mr. Heck had regarding the prevailing case law, and something we haven't even talked about is the moratorium. The only point I wanted to make was the recent Lake Tahoe case by the U.S. Supreme Court was a prima facie challenge as to whether any moratorium at any time for any reason constituted a taking because it deprived property of all economically beneficial use. I want to stress to the court that we are not challenging the initial four-month term of the moratorium.
Phil?
There was a developer of properties in that area that was...
what number? What percentage?
It was
90%.
I think 90%.
Well, okay, if we have to accept that, presuming in favor of the trial court's legal finding, what about the factual and legal sufficiency challenge to that presumption?
The evidence was admitted, and I don't think that there was a point of error or an issue.
Can I make one point, Chief Justice? I apologize.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
This deals with the first question that Mr. Heck had regarding the prevailing case law, and something we haven't even talked about is the moratorium. The only point I wanted to make was the recent Lake Tahoe case by the U.S. Supreme Court was a prima facie challenge as to whether any moratorium at any time for any reason constituted a taking because it deprived property of all economically beneficial use. I want to stress to the court that we are not challenging the initial four-month term of the moratorium, but stating requesting the court to rule that after that point, that the only governmental purpose was to hold Mr. Sheffield hostage, so he would try to acquiesce to a lower density development plan. Did not substantially advance the legitimate governmental interest. Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize for that.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments today, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.